Everybody knows that when you listen to Sisters Who Kill, if there's an HBCU, we say shout out to the HBCUs. And the thing is, it's because HBCUs have such a rich history. Throughout the years of being denied education because of the color of our skin, HBCUs have come together and they have built a legacy that most of us still live on today. And you can too. Introducing Sacred Heart Collections, founded by Spelman alum Brandy Wallace. Sacred Heart is an amazing company that manufactures Greek and HBCU clothing. They are currently in like some big stores like Belk, Lids, Academy Sports, and now you can get some for yourself. I love this site. It's got some amazing HBCUs on there and beautiful, beautiful designs. Shout out to Brandy being the creative director on her brand because these sweatshirts are so good. Tazzy just finished getting her project management certification at Spelman. So she was like, oh, I need to get a Spelman sweatshirt. And it looks so amazing. I got my boo a Morehouse sweatshirt and the quality. Let me tell you guys, the quality. And it is probate season. So I know that you're looking for the most amazing gift for your people. Go to Sacred Heart, give them something unique, something that they can be proud of, something that you can be proud to give to them. Now go on over to sacredheartcollections.com and check out these amazing schools that they have, the Greek apparel that is available. I promise you, this brand, honestly, I have the sweatshirts. It is about quality. It really is. You are going to have this sweatshirt. You're going to have this jacket, whatever you decide to get, for years and years to come. And you can get 20% off your order with the discount code SISTERS. That's right, amazing quality to rep your HBCU while getting a little discount from Sisters Who Kill with the discount code SISTERS. That's SISTAS. Get you something amazing. I can't wait to see what you look like. And a big shout out to the HBCUs. What's going on, everybody? I'm Marah.
And I'm Taz.
And welcome back to Sisters Who Kill. When that man love you, he will do anything for you. Anything you need for him to see a smile on your face. But what happens when the thing that you need, you love more than you love him? Does that rhyme? I don't know. Cue the music.
Our players this week are William Eric Clark, the victim and Constance's husband, Jean-Pierre Devon, accomplice and Constance's cousin, Christopher Tumlin, accomplice, Corey Branch, accomplice, maybe, and Constance Clark, our murderess.
Constance Chanel Clark Harris was born in 1973 in Birmingham, Alabama. While she was there, her dad worked for U.S. Steel, and apparently working for U.S. Steel is like the place to work. You're going to get a good pension. It puts you into a nice middle class tax bracket when you're working at U.S. Steel. People from Birmingham will tell us. Anyways, their family was extremely large, and she loved hanging out. She loved being surrounded by her friends. She loved being surrounded by her family, and they would just always have a family get together. If you all live together and you all love each other, the family is going to hang out. Anyways, she graduated from Bessemer County High School, and she didn't really have plans after high school. She didn't really want to go to college or anything like that, but what she did want to do is get out of her parents' house. So she found herself a job as a bank teller. Then she decided she was going to move in with her cousin, and her cousin lived in like downtown Birmingham. She lived with her cousin. She was working, and things seemed to be going pretty well for her. And of course, like, she's young, she's cute. She was dating, and she wasn't seriously dating at this time. She was just having friends. And then one day, one of her friends was like, oh, girl, I know this dude. He would be perfect for you. And she was like, really? And she was like, yes. I'm gonna set y'all up on a blind date. I know you don't do that, girl, but listen, I'm gonna set you up on a blind date.
I want you to meet him, and I feel like I'm Cupid right now, so please go on this date. And she's like, okay, girl, I'll go on the date. And that is how she met William Eric Clark.
William Eric Clark, he went by Eric, was born September 6, 1970. He was born to his dad, William Clark, and mom, Janice Clark. He had two sisters, Kimberly and April, and one brother, Philip. They grew up in a rougher neighborhood than Constance did. He definitely had a different upbringing, but the family made it work the best they could. His friend Antoine Bell said that he was extremely close to his family. He feels like his family and his support unit was why he didn't get subject to the streets or whatever. You know what I'm saying? When most people, when they grow up in these rough neighborhoods, it's like you end up dead or in jail. And like when you got a good support system around you and when people care about what's happening to you and you feel cared about what's going to happen to your future, you end up making better decisions. And his friends in high school, they took different paths and stuff, but he stayed on the straight and narrow and made something out of his life. He graduated and he enlisted in the Navy because a lot of people who feel like they don't have no options go to the military.
Like, exactly. Mm-hmm.
They know they're going to have health insurance. They know they're going to have benefits. It's a good way to establish a nice foundation when you don't have a lot to build off of. But he did not serve long. One day while he was on the ship, there was an explosion that happened, and it killed some of his shipmates. One of them actually died in his arms, and that was enough for him. He did not like that. It was very traumatizing. So he finished whatever time he had left on his contract at that moment, and he got out.
I think I would do the same.
Right, like, I'm not even at war. I'm just here, the ship blown up. Could have been me. Niggas dying in my arms. No, that's not what work should be. After leaving the Navy, he moves back to Birmingham with his parents, and he starts working at a local bakery. He found so much joy in this. Like, it eased his anxiety. He just loved, like, working with his hands and creating things that made people smile. You know me, I see a cookie, my eyes light up. I'm excited, you know, and just be able to bring that joy to people.
It reminds me of the backstory for Struggle Beard Bakery. Like,
listen,
it's not
literally,
app.
Right? I was watching that part. I was like, this is him.
Right. So Struggle Beard Bakery sends us cookies from time to time, and they're great. They love the show. Hey, and he is a vet and found joy and peace by using his hands, especially after the war, and, like, good cookies. Mm-hmm. Good cookies.
And not like your regular flavor cookies. Like, he be doing something with them.
Okay.
Now, one thing about Eric was he was a very hard worker. He ain't had no problem getting up every day and going to work, making that money. Like, especially when you're doing something you love, it's easier to do, right? But Eric was also a bit of a hopeless romantic. He just wanted to be loved, and he wanted to love somebody. He had one relationship early on, and he was like, I'm ready to get married. And she was not. And she was like, it's not where I'm going right now. I think we should call it off. And he was left heartbroken. It just left him wanting more. Like, damn, I really want a family. I really want a wife. I want the kids. I want it all. Like, I want to be able to start my life in my family. Because especially being from a close-knit family, like, you just want to be able to go and have your own and lead that own. One day in 1998, Eric meets Constance. She's 25. He's 28. And it was like a blind date situation, but they had an instant connection. He was like, she's got potential, man. She could really be my wife. Because, like, at this point, that's his goal. So, like, everybody he's dating, like, is she wifey material?
Dating with a purpose.
Right. They found that they had a lot of things in common, one specifically being cooking. Like, he was the baker and she was the cooker. So the full meal was there with dessert. And they just had a good time in the kitchen. And it's nice when you can be able to share your passion with somebody who you love. Like, it's mm-hmm. one thing to enjoy it solo, but to enjoy it with somebody else you love, whether it's them just eating your food or whether it's them making the food with you or for you, it's a nice bonding activity. And he was very romantic. I'm talking candlelight dinners, rose petals. He was
treat
like, I want
nice.
You to know. You know what I'm saying? I want
I'm
you to
that
know.
Girl.
I'm going to hold you up and I'm going to hold you down.
Give me an experience.
After a while dating, Eric decided to introduce Constance to his family. Of course, he was like, I'm really looking to put a ring on that. Like, I'm thinking she's the one. And they liked Constance for him. It was like she was cool, very nice personality. Like, I thought they were a great match. They seemed so in love with each other. Everybody except for his mama. She was like, I'm trying to be supportive, but it's something off. I don't know. I don't know what it is. Maybe I feel like it's a little too fast. Maybe it's just mama's intuition, but it's off. But of course, like, you can't be telling your son, I don't like her. Why? I don't know. I just don't like her. Like, you ain't trying to put a wedge in between you and your son or nothing. So you just, you wait for everything.
He seemed happy.
Right. Be happy for him that he's happy. They actually do end up getting engaged, and they got married in February of 1999. So this is a year or less after they met.
Yeah. Like 10 months.
Yeah, this is like 10 months after they met. They are married, locked in.
They put together a ceremony. I would think that quick, we'll just go, I wear a cute white dress to the courthouse. No, they had a whole ceremony.
Yeah, nice little dress and everything, cute little wedding pictures.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, Mom was trying to say marriage right now, 10 months, it feels a little fast. But he was like, Mom, my heart's in it. I'm going to go with it. And he did.
I feel like he was just one of those people, like, he knew that he was meant to be a husband, meant to be a father, those type of things. So that was his goal. Okay, here we are. We're married. We're not married. We're married. And Eric needed to start thinking about the big picture, the longevity. One of the things that they wanted was to start a family. And at this point, Constance was making a lot more money than Eric was. Like, he was working at the bakery, but that wasn't bringing in nearly as much money as she was making as a bank teller or doing what she was doing now, which was a nurse's aide at a nursing facility. So Constance's dad, he worked at the U.S. Steel plant. He put in a good word for Eric. Eric got a job at the steel plant. So now Constance at least knows that she is going to grow up with the level of security that she grew up with. And that's a nice, like, starting ground. Like, we've got everything we need. Everything is starting to be taken care of. And Eric, he's a doting husband. He got money now. Yeah, baby, I'm gonna buy you the nicest car on the block. Yeah, baby, we're gonna go out and have romantic dinners. We're still in the honeymoon phase. And that was great because Constance expected the best and she got the best. But very soon into their relationship, they got, what, married in 99? So the first year through their relationship, of course, they're trying to make a baby. And they are practicing a lot. And still, she's not pregnant. So it's frustrating. So they go to the doctor. And the doctor checks out Eric, checks out Constance, says, yes, everything is working the way that it should. And Constance was like, okay, we're still not getting pregnant. And so the doctor says, have you thought about losing some weight? And Constance kind of sits there like she's always been a heavyset girl. Like, she's beautiful, but she's always been a heavyset girl. And she's like, it's a struggle that she's constantly had. And since this doctor is now suggesting that this is the reason why she can't bear children, she's like, I got to get this weight off. And so in her mind, it immediately goes to gastric bypass surgery. And Eric is like, nah, baby, I think that I love you. I love you the way you are. More cushion for the pushing. If you do want to lose weight, that's fine. Let's do it the old-fashioned way. We can go to the gym together. And see, niggas think that that's cute. I don't want to go to the gym with you.
I honestly would like somebody to work me out. Motivate me.
Tazzy, you and I can go to the gym together. I don't want to go to the gym with my nigga. Like, no, I don't want to. I felt her on this, but he was like, if you want to lose weight the old-fashioned way, that is the preferred method. I do not want you going under any type of procedure. And she's like, no, this is what we need to do. It's a struggle that I've always had. I've done the working out. I have lived in this body way before you came into the picture. I already know what the struggles are going to be. I just want the surgery. And he's like, oh, I don't want it.
But being that supportive-ass husband.
Right. In 2001, she ends up having the surgery. Because I get it. Like, gastric bypass surgery, it was 2001. That's like when Biggest Loser started coming on. I get it. And she wanted the surgery. And the surgery went okay. I feel like gastric bypass surgery just became a thing in 2001. Doesn't that feel like that?
I can't say for sure. I was in the first grade in 2001.
I was as well, but like, I don't know. But I'm also like was surrounded by heavyset people. So we just always talked about it. Okay, anyways, the surgery went okay. There were a couple of times that she almost coded. It wasn't the best, but she made it out. She went home and she was telling Eric, like, I don't think this is supposed to feel like this. Like, this really hurts. So the pain got so bad one night that the medicine that they gave her wasn't really working. And so he ends up calling the hospital. They go to the hospital, and apparently the way that they put her back together was wrong. So more people had to go and put her back together.
Not Humpty Dumpty.
You know what I'm saying? They gave her pain medicine, but of course they're opioids. The goal is that you need them for when you need them, and then you wean yourself off of them, right? Because I remember when I had a surgery and they gave me opioids, and I was like, whew, one is good. I will feel the rest. Those are strong drugs. Those are strong drugs.
If you're looking for a good time.
If that's what you're into, that's the thing about the drugs. They make you numb. You don't feel the pain. You don't feel anything. You pretty much can just sleep without pain. And that is what she needed at the time. And so when her prescription ran out, Constance was not happy because she needed to not feel the pain. She said the pain was unbearable. And Eric knew at this point, like, he almost saw his wife die on the table. He knows that she...
Okay, everybody, we all just had Easter. We all were around our families, and we all know that it was awkward. And I don't know if anybody else is having this problem, but it felt like everybody cared about my womb. Ma'am, sir, old lady, I am not even married, and you are worried about my reproductive system that has nothing to do with you. People can be so invasive, and that makes it very difficult to talk about things that are really going on with you. So it's important for us to have a good doctor. How do we find a good doctor? Well, I've got the perfect thing for you. ZocDoc. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online, because doctors are the only people that I actually want to have these intimate personal conversations with. All of these doctors have verified reviews from actual real patients. You can filter specifically for ones that take your insurance, ones that are located next to you. There are pictures of the doctor so you can see what they look like, and hopefully that will help your comfort level. And you can book right on the app, which is an amazing. Typically you can see your doctor within 24 to 72 hours, which chef's kiss. And this can be for an array of doctors. Taz and I have used it because, you know, insurance is starting back up. It's time to go see all of the specialists. And my birthday is coming up, which is the time that I usually just make all of my appointments by my birthday so I never forget. And ZocDoc has been amazing with helping me find new in-network physicians in my area. So go to ZocDoc.com/SWK and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/SWK. ZocDoc.com/SWK. It's 2024 and everybody has money on their mind. Do you? Did you know that you were paying for that subscription twice? Do you know that you're still paying for a subscription and you haven't opened the app since 1994? Well, I've got something that will help you out. It is called Rocket Money. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. I have been trying to save money for a while, but it seemed like my bank account was stuck. Thankfully, I heard about Rocket Money and I gave it a try. It turns out I had a bunch of subscriptions that I was paying for and I forgot about. Well, Rocket Money helped me cancel some of them, and now I'm finally starting to see my account look like a real account. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and have saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. So stop wasting money on things that you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/sisters. That's rocketmoney.com/sisters. S-I-S-T-A-S. rocketmoney.com/sisters.
To some type of pain, right? And so he tries to help. Okay, I can probably get some pills from here, or I know so-and-so down the street's wife just had surgery. People don't usually use the whole prescription. I can buy some off of him. And she loses a lot of weight. They still try to get pregnant. No baby. No baby. And Erica, every time she is not taking a pill. She is screaming for a pill, saying that she's in pain. And Eric, drugs are expensive. I just want everybody to know that drugs are expensive. Before you decide to choose drugs, you know what? I think that's what they should have said in the DARE program. Drugs are expensive. You want to do drugs, you're going to be broke. Because one pill on the street is $20. Mind you, when you actually are prescribed them, they're fairly cheap. But on the street, they're $20 each. And she's at the point where one doesn't work. She needs three at a time. You need a $60 high.
$60. Probably 2 to 3 times a day.
That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money.
And what's frustrating about it is, like, part of the addiction, part of it, don't even be chasing a high. It be wanting to have a manageable life, like, not be in pain. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You don't even realize what life is like without the pain. And now she's taking it so much that if she doesn't take it, she's going to relapse. Because she's now so addicted to them. They're so used to being in her system. And guess who was footing the bill? Eric, of course, is trying to do whatever Constance needs. He's picking up double shifts. He goes to work, comes home from work, makes himself some food, takes himself a quick little nap, puts his boots on, and goes back to work. He's the one that has to go and find the drug dealers. He ain't no drug dealer. He wasn't that type of dude. But, you know, he knew about drugs, like, in his community. But he was the person that everybody knew wasn't really doing it like that. And now he's got to go seek the drug dealers and not just a weed man. You can find a weed. You can throw a rock and find a weed man. You got to go find pills. That's a hard gig to do. So at this point, Eric is at his wit's end. He also picked up a weekend job bartending for like special events, and he needs a break and she needs help. He knows this. And so in 2004, he and her sit down and he's like, baby, I love you. I want the best for you. I want us to grow in this marriage. Baby, I just think that we need to get you into a facility, check you into rehab. I know that the pain is great, but I think that we can work together for us to have the life that we always dreamed of. Baby, this ain't the life that we always dreamed of. You know that we want more than this. You know that we're both committed to having a family, committed to having a child. We can't have a child on opioids. I want to check you into rehab. I'm working. I put money aside to pay for this rehab. Will you go? And she's like, you know what, baby, you're absolutely right. I will. I'll go. And she goes off to rehab. Rehab is for a certain amount of time. All of a sudden, Eric is sitting at home and his wife busts through the door. And he's like, baby, what are you doing here? And she's like, I'm back. I don't want to talk about it. I'm not staying at that rehab place. They got me fucked up. And I don't want to hear shit else about it.
You know they won't give me no
pills. You know they won't give me shit. You know if people do that, you still have to pay for the whole time, right?
And I hate to waste some money, I tell you what.
They're already struggling to get by. And he's footing the bill. She lost her job, especially after rehab. Like, she was working a little bit, and she would take pills to make sure that she could get throughout the day. But once she went to rehab and things started really getting bad, she ended up not working. So he's footing the bill for everything. She's back from rehab, and everybody knows that she is struggling with the pills. Eric is starting to confide in his sisters and say, you know, things are really bad. Like, I don't know how much longer I can take this. Not just the addiction, but this is not the family that I dreamed of for myself. This is not the life that I dreamed of for myself. And I really feel like maybe divorce is an option. I'm not sure. Constance is bad. She's paranoid if she's home alone. They said one time a broom fell in the kitchen and she got so scared, she pulled out the gun and started 007 around the house, which I get. Everybody's made that sound bad, but I get it. I might not have the gun, but I'm gonna have like a baseball bat or something. Mm-hmm. But I also don't do that. I guess that's why I have dogs.
Right.
Because they're gonna find you before I do.
You go check it out. They'll be like, not without you. I'm gonna walk in front of me.
I can tell by the dogs. Like, they know when to bark. Mm-hmm. Like, if they hear something, they might go do a small bark. But then we both get real quiet, and I know they listen.
And I see that hair standing up on their back. I'll be like, oh, you nervous too? Shit. Hold on.
All right. And so I'd be real quiet so they can listen with their supersonic ears. Is someone in the house? Mm-hmm. And then I know if I need to pull out a weapon.
Right.
And then came the year 2005. And that was a year for them, okay? The arguments are bad. The money is thin. The pills are still expensive. One time, Eric pulls up to his home where he pays the bills. He got off of work early. And his wife had another nigga in the house. And apparently this is one of a few niggas that she had around mm-hmm. the house. And when they describe these people on the film versions, they were saying that these weren't guys like Eric. These were niggas that ran the streets of Birmingham. So what it was giving, I don't know if it was true, but what it was giving was that she was fucking for some pills.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's giving. But the money was thin.
One way or another.
Oh, and she looked good. She was losing that weight, baby.
Mm-hmm.
I give everybody said she looked good.
I ain't gonna hold you. They struggled. It was just rough, man. Eric trying to maintain the house on his own, her addiction on his own. Not only that, but like, he had these dreams of a marriage, a wife supporting. She cooked and shit. They loved each other. They were supposed to have kids. They'd been trying for years at this point. No baby. She over here fucking other niggas in the house while he trying to make sure she can live at least a comfortable life. Free of pain. Busting his ass.
In my house, where I pay the bills.
And shit got really tight and shit got really hard. And Eric ended up having to file for bankruptcy. And at some point in 2005, he goes to her parents, or they go to her parents, and they're like, listen, can you co-sign on a loan for $10,000? They're like, promise we'll pay you the money back. And they took their word for it. Like, Eric ain't never not been working, right? Mm-hmm. Eric always hold it down. He's a trustworthy nigga. Of course, they want to support them in this time if they can, if they're able to, right? Around this time, Eric and Constance, they are at each other's throats. It's miserable in that house. Like, can you imagine on a busting your ass all day? The man had to give up his dream job in the bakery. Now he working in a steel mill. You just busting your ass all day to come home, not get treated with no respect. Don't get treated with no care, no love, no comfort. And then get up and bust your ass for the same person. It's crazy. At one point, the argument gets so bad between the two of them, Constance gonna go and pull a gun in Eric's face. I don't know. Eric was probably like, when the fuck did we get on this level? Like, are you kidding me?
I'm telling you, you only have one time to pull a gun on me, and I am out of there.
I mean, what?
I am out of there. I don't care how heated the argument gets.
You want to play with my life? You're tripping.
I'm done. We are good right there.
You ain't
got
to point it at me. If you sit there and put it in your hand like you want to think about pointing at me. Me?
Mm-mm. You better not touch it.
Like, at this point, shit's so bad, they can't even... It's either... I don't know if it's that they can't hide it or they no longer want to keep up the facade. Like, when your relationship has trouble, sometimes you want to keep shit close to home because, like, you don't want to hear outside opinions. But you know you ready to let shit go when you start talking to other people. And they be like, yeah, shit's fucked up and I'm just... So both of their families know shit's just not great at the house. And it was sad to see because, again, in the beginning, they were so in love with each other. They seemed perfect for each other. And how do we get to this? Eric's confiding in his sisters. He's mentioning that he wants to leave Constance. But also, another part of him is like, I vowed till death do us part. This is really a struggle for him. It feels like he's quitting. And mama ain't raised no hoe.
Right. And you're supposed to be there as a man. You're supposed to hold down... the household. You're supposed mm-hmm. to hold down your wife through thick or through thin.
For better or for worse, right? But shit has been worse for a while, man. I'm waiting on some better. Constance over here running her mouth talking about she tired of Eric. Like, what the hell do you have to be tired from?
And tell me, what have you done for me lately?
One day, she decides, I'm gonna go through my cousin purse or whatever. Her cousin who moved in with her after high school, that cousin. The cousin that at least had some type of closeness because y'all lived together, got a place together, right?
Mm-hmm.
She goes and takes her cousin's information behind her back and applies for a $10,000 bank loan, just pretending to be her cousin. On June 24th of 2005, loan comes through from the bank. Cool. So what does she do with this $10,000? On June 27th, just 3 days later.
The logical thing, of course.
Of course, would be to take out a life insurance policy on Eric for $500,000. She takes out a $300,000 life insurance policy on herself. I guess trying to cover her tracks, but also, ma'am, what if you did die? from your drug addiction and stuff.
Don't be suspicious. Listen,
why you get $500,000, he only get $300,000.
And why doesn't he already have a life insurance policy? He is a military vet.
He didn't finish. He didn't go full time, so his benefits are limited. Yeah, you got to do a certain amount of years to get full benefits. A little while later, she takes out her life insurance policy for $100,000, just to pad it a little bit. What did she need this $10,000 for? To make sure that it would go into effect immediately. We could die at any moment. So make that shit pay. If he died tomorrow, I want to get paid, all right?
The very next day. Thank you so much.
Okay. So she made sure that shit was ready to be paid. It's just a couple months later. She got the life insurance policies at the end of June, right? One day, she runs into Eric's friend, Antoine, at the grocery store outside a barbershop, some shit, right? He's like, hey, Constance, how you doing? And she's like, oh, hey, Antoine, I'm good. He was like, that's good to hear, man. You looking good. How my boy Eric doing? She was like, fuck Eric. She said, I need to collect some insurance money on his ass. Why would you say that to his friend? This ain't your homegirl. This his homeboy.
What? And it seems like she said it very sarcastically. Where at first
very sarcastically,
think
but like...
Like, fuck that nigga. I'm finna kill his ass.
Right. Like, I'd have been like, how do you walk away from that conversation? Hey, were y'all, like, I'm gonna call my friend, do a wellness check. You know, bitches out here joking about killing you for money.
How you doing, man? You still alive?
Right.
You good?
Checking. I don't know. I just heard some crazy shit today.
Had a dream. Just thought I saw a premonition.
It's like, she says this, and it starts to, personally, is Constance really thinking about doing this for real? Like, most of the jokes that are funny is funny because it's true.
Right.
So, she's kiki-ing a little, but, like, also, I don't think she would mind that at all. Okay. So, now that everything's in place, she got the life insurance policy set. She got... She start working out a plan. She's ready. It's go time. So she calls up her first cousin, Jean-Pierre. Jean-Pierre Ahmad Devon was born in 1981. He is first cousins with Constance. He was born in Atlanta. He grew up in a nice neighborhood. Both parents didn't need street life, but, you know, some people just, they gravitate towards it. He worked private security for events, nightclubs, and stuff like that. He did have a sister, Ashley, who describes him as gracious, loving, dependable. He had kids, and he loved spending time with his kids. He loved music. A pretty well-rounded fellow. But Ashley feels like his true calling was to be a comedian. Because he was a joke. In his free time, he was also a coach and a mentor in his community. I mean, he seems like a nice guy. I guess everybody got a dark side to him. Because for whatever reason... Constance knew this was the nigga to call. Like, that's her cousin and all, but, like, they don't talk constantly. And I've got cousins like that. It ain't no love lost or nothing. We just don't speak on a daily. But, like, if I do get on the phone with you, we can chop it up. But for whatever reason, she knew this was the nigga to call.
But also, like, my first cousin, like, even though we don't talk all the time, like, he don't play about me. When I tell you somebody
exactly.
That don't play.
We don't gotta talk all the time to know I'm gonna hold it the fuck down for you when you need me to, all right?
Exactly.
She gets on the phone with him. She was like, what's up, cuz? He said, what's up, cousin? What's going on? She was like, nothing. It's just this nigga Eric stressing me out. He's like, what's going on? She like, man, he's abusive. And he been hiding money from me. We've been struggling. And he out here hiding money. And I'm tired. Maybe you can help me out with this situation. And I got $5,000 in it for you. And he like, oh, word? I think a part of him is like, I mean, he fucking with you and I get paid. Like, I might work something out for my cousin. And after this conversation, their phone calls get a little bit more frequent. Now, on December 13th of 2005, Eric's got to make a drive to Atlanta. He, again, has been working all the shifts. So he is spending nights working as a bartender. And in Alabama, the alcohol is pricey.
It is. Liquor laws in Alabama, as well as tobacco laws in Alabama, are so Bible Belt. When I went to college and I could not buy Orello because I was 18, threw me for a loop.
It was my cousin coming down here from like up north or something. And we tried to go to the liquor store and she was like, closed? Why would it be closed? And I'm like, oh, it's Sunday. She's like, what? Niggas drink on Sunday? You do, but
not here. Not before 12 p.m. on a Sunday.
You better go praise the Lord first.
The liquor laws in Alabama are strict. And you know it's a felony to cross state lines with liquor? I bet y'all didn't know that.
Mm-mm, because they doing it every weekend. They sure don't. He's like, it's really worth it to make that 3-hour drive to Atlanta. Like, even gas and time and everything, it's going to save him that much more money to go and just get a bulk order in Atlanta and bring it back. And so, I mean, he need every dollar, right? So he go and make that drive. He had just worked a 12, 13-hour shift at the steel plant. He doesn't want to get caught up. It's December 13th. Everybody trying to get some liquor and shit. He don't want to get holiday traffic or nothing. So he like, let me go ahead and make this drive. It's December 13th, so it's holiday season. He wants to be stocked with liquor, right? So he's like, let me go ahead and make this drive. So once he gets to Atlanta, he calls his wife's cousin, Jean-Pierre. Like, what's up, JP? Constance said you can hook me up with some cheap liquor spots. He's like, you know, I got you. So Jean-Pierre calls a guy named Corey. Now, Corey Branch, also known as Big Corey, he grew up with Jean-Pierre. They played a bunch of sports together. That was his bro name, partner name. And when Jean-Pierre would need help with a situation, he can always count on his guy, Corey. Now, although Jean-Pierre seemed all clean on the outside, his bestie for the restie was not. He was a known drug dealer. If you need it, he got it. So Jean-Pierre's like letting Corey in. Jean-Pierre calls Corey in. He's like, hey, man, I got something I'm about to do tonight. I'm going to need a gun. I got some shit that's about to go down tonight. And Corey's like, I mean, I got you, but maybe I should ride with you. And then Corey calls Chris. Now, Christopher Rashad Tumlin is born in 1981. He's got a criminal record, but nothing aggressive, just a couple of weed charges, right? Now, Corey calls Chris because Corey got to get this gun for Jean-Pierre. Corey didn't have one that Jean-Pierre could use at the time, because I find it hard to believe that he didn't have one. He didn't have one that Jean-Pierre could use at the time, but he was like, Chris gonna be the one to call. So they pull up on Chris, and they buy a gun from him for $125. For whatever reason, Chris decides he wants to join the party. So Chris, Corey, and Jean-Pierre are riding around together. They go to a gas station. They out in Austell by Six Flags. And they waiting on Eric to pull up so they can meet to go get the liquor. Now, Eric don't got no suspicions, you know what I mean? Eric's on his way. He was tired. He just worked a 12, 13-hour shift before he got on the road. So he was not planning on turning around the same night. So he had a family friend in Atlanta who he planned on staying with. And he calls his friend. He was like, hey, man, I'm in town. It's like 9 o'clock now. I got one more stop, and I'm going to be pulling up at your house. And he's like, all right, bro, call me when you're outside. I'll get the door for you. He's like, all right, see you soon. So the stop he had to make, of course, was to meet with Jean-Pierre. And Jean-Pierre's like, all right, follow me to this place. I'm going to take you to the discount liquor store. Eric like, all right, bro, got you. Following. Jean-Pierre drives to Water's Edge, which is a subdivision off Yuppam Road. And he stopped in front of a house that was having... The neighborhood was under construction. Like, this was a newly developed neighborhood. Only two houses were built at this time. And they were in the process of building the other houses in the neighborhood. So it ain't a lot of people out here, really. It's the middle of the night.
They said it was only, two other families? Because they're...
Yeah, there was only two houses built in that neighborhood at the time. And so, like, the rest of the neighborhood was still under construction. And people were living in the houses at the time, but, like, only two families. Mm-hmm. It's not a full neighborhood.
And the only reason that Jean-Pierre knew it existed is because he works different things and he was dropping off supplies there. So he knew that this place was supposed to be quiet.
He was working at a lumber yard.
Right,
and he
had
to deliver lumber there for the construction project. And he was like, seems like a good enough spot for me. So
what a great way to get rid of a body.
So Jean-Pierre gets out the car. Eric gets out the car. He's like, where are we at, bro? Christopher and Corey, they stay in the car. And then all of a sudden, they see Jean-Pierre start shooting Eric. Boom, boom. Christopher jumps out the car, was like, yo, I ain't not coming here to watch you murder somebody. Like, what the fuck is this shit? Like, this is not what I thought we was on tonight. Honestly, Chris thought they was going to do a little robbing.
Because he had cash on him, right?
Right. It was like Chris was like, oh, the gun is to rob this nigga. He's coming in town to buy liquor. He got money on him, like $500. It's a good lick. He was like, you just shooting it. He ain't even trying to rob him yet. You just shot him. So Chris and Jean-Pierre arguing, but Eric's not dead yet. Eric tries to get up and tries to go back to his car. He's moaning, groaning, trying to run, fight for his life. Jean-Pierre looks up and shoots him two more times. One lands in the back of his head. Christopher is freaking out. He was like, this nigga's cold-blooded. Like, what the fuck is going on? He don't want nothing to do with these niggas, right? And he rolled with them. This nigga goes and hops in Eric's car just to leave. He said, I ain't want nothing to do with that. Jean-Pierre calls Eric's phone, which Chris answers. I guess it was left in the car. So Chris answers Eric's phone, and he says, hey, listen, nigga, don't ever call me again. I'm about to drop this car off, and this the last time we're going to speak to each other. Like, don't ever reach out to me again.
So which is very much something I would say if I was in his situation. Don't look for me. Don't contact me. Don't even sniff in my direction.
Ever. So Jean-Pierre, like, fuck it, works for me. He gets back in his car. He drives off. Then he calls Constance and let her know the deed has been done. He calls Christopher back one more time and just to make sure the fear of God is in him. Say anything, nigga, I'm going to fuck you up. I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill your parents. Anything. Don't tell nobody shit about what you just seen. And Chris is like, shit, nigga. Like I said, we don't even know each other no more.
I wouldn't have answered the phone. Hello? Who is this?
Right. Didn't I tell you don't call me no more, nigga? Get the fuck off the phone.
I wouldn't have even said that. Who are you? I'm sorry.
That's
you
what
have
you
the
say
wrong
while
number.
Looking at the phone. Decline. Block. Delete. Who?
I get it. There's no caller ID. He might probably was calling on the house phone. Who is this?
It's 2005. It's caller ID.
Not every house had caller ID in 2005. I didn't.
It come up on a little cordless thing. I don't think it was a separate thing in 2005. Unless, like, you just had, like, a old, like, I had cordless.
We didn't have a cordless phone in our house. The cordless phone was in my mom's office. Yeah, the one with the long, squiggly cord. Mm-hmm. And he probably had that at his house, too. Now, little did everybody know, like Tazzy said, there were two families already living in that neighborhood. And when they heard the gunshots and their new neighborhood and this new establishment, they looked out the window. Now, College Park, especially in 2005, was not the safest place to be in Atlanta. You already knew that. But this was a part that was supposed to be built and built very nicely. So when they look out the window, they see a Chevy Caprice and some type of gray car fleeing the scene. And they knew that the Chevy Caprice was maroon. So the police are like, okay, we're looking for a maroon car and we're looking for this grayish white car. Police show up and they find Eric dead on the ground from a gunshot wound to the head. He was easy to identify because his wallet was with him. His ID was in there. So, great. We know exactly who this is. We know exactly how to contact the next of kin. And at this time, they're calling Constance. They're like, we just found your husband. He's deceased. And it's just very interesting. He's from Birmingham, and he was found here in Atlanta. But Atlanta is known to be a place where there's carjackings. Like, this College Park, carjackings. He could have got robbed. Maybe it was a drug deal gone bad, ma'am. Does he...
South Atlanta by the airport.
You know, and she's like, ma'am, do you know that if he was going to do anything like that, like maybe pick up drugs? And she's like, my husband don't do drugs. He don't deal drugs. But he was headed to Atlanta to get some liquor.
She said, that's all me, baby.
She did.
My process at the end of the day needed work. I had either been running on fumes the entire day, so I completely crash at the end of the day, or my body knows that it's time to wind down, but I haven't done a good job of actually winding down. Luckily, I found Hatch. Hatch is amazing. It has really transformed my nighttime schedule. I am more intentional about when I go to sleep, and Hatch has amazing sounds and lights to help me relax into my evening so that I can really feel refreshed in the morning. There are a million things that don't want you to sleep at night, but Hatch does. Hatch helps you choose sleep and creative bedtime habits that make you feel better at night and energized in the morning. I love listening to the sounds. I love listening to the stories so that I can just go to sleep. And now with a Hatch Plus subscription, you can unlock premium routine building features like cue to unwind, which signals when it's time for bed, and pillow talk, an audio series which is just like your favorite bedtime TV show without the screens that are keeping you up. Ooh, I'm very bad about that. Right now, Hatch is offering our listeners $20 off your purchase of the Hatch Restore and free shipping at hatch.co/sisters. Visit hatch.co/sisters, S-I-S-T-A-S, to get $20 off and free shipping. And go get some sleep.
Say that. Drugs, no, that's my lane. And so they were like, okay, this is a break in the case. Do you know who he was looking for? And she was like, yes, he was supposed to be meeting up with my cousin, Jean-Pierre. And Jean-Pierre was going to show him, like, the place in Atlanta. And he was supposed to stay with somebody else after that.
Do you want to know what one of my favorite sounds are? Here it is. That's the sound I hear when I am learning a new language with Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be your favorite sound too. I have been learning French with Babbel. I think I've told you guys that I have been learning French and I love these lessons. It's different from other language learning apps because I feel like it's less of a game and more of a real lesson. Now, they never said that Babbel was going to be easy, but what I do know is that Babbel has been helping me learn, okay? It's designed by real people so that you can have real conversations. One of the things that I really love about the Babbel app is that I can learn a lesson, and then I have a podcast to listen to about that lesson where people are learning, and I am actively finding myself talking to the podcast, learning my little bit of French. So if learning a new language is on your to-do list, because we're trying to be international, baby, make sure that you check out Babbel. And right now, here is a limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, you can get 55% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners because we're just like that. So go to babbel.com/SWK. That's right. Get 55% off at babbel.com/SWK. That's babbel.com/SWK. Rules and restrictions may apply. I can't wait to hear all of your languages.
Now, when Constance tells Eric's family about the murder, of course, she tells them what the police told her. They said that he was robbed in Atlanta and he was shot in the head. And this man got sisters. And they were like, that nigga did not get robbed. His sister and his mom was like, ain't nobody finna rob my brother. He had nothing for you to rob. I don't know. I think she got something to do with it. And so the family is sitting around chit-chatting. And of course, his sister starts spilling the tea. And his sister's like, yeah, I was talking to Eric and he was telling me about how he was fed up with her, about her being on drugs and that he was sick of funding this habit. And it was really getting out of hand. And he was talking about divorcing. Why would he be in Atlanta? I think that it wasn't a drug deal gone bad. I think that
it was her setting him up because she wanted to make sure that he was out of the picture so that she could get some money. And while they was in there talking shit, Constance was in the other room and she heard it. And Constance, a bitch like me, you ain't finna be talking about me and think I'm not finna say nothing.
I heard that you was looking for me.
She bust in that room. How dare you say that I had anything to do with my husband dying? I love that man. I loved Eric so much. I would never do nothing to my husband. How? I can't believe that y'all would even think that. Everything that I've done for him, everything that I've done for you all, I thought we were family. This is a hard time. You guys want to turn y'all fingers at me? You want to turn your head?
Family, my ass. Bitch, you know you did it.
How dare you? And so she was going off, and the argument started getting heated. And then the matriarch of the family, Eric's grandma, finally spoke. That's when everybody calms down. And she was like, basically, like, at the end of the day got to end. And we're not going to talk about this again until after the funeral. Everybody just calm down. Eric's funeral was held on December 19th, 2005. And the police back in Atlanta were still investigating this case. And one of the things that they remembered when they talked to Constance was Jean-Pierre. So they decided to look into him. And they knew a bit about him. He didn't have that much of a criminal record. He worked in Atlanta with the youth. He seemed to have his life on track. He made great money. He also worked at night as a security guard. The police started formulating a theory. Maybe Jean-Pierre knew that Eric was coming to town, knew that he was coming with cash on him to buy this liquor, and he decided that he was just going to shoot him. He was going to rob him. And maybe it was a robbery gone bad. So they bring in Jean-Pierre for questioning. And Jean-Pierre is like, no, he was supposed to meet up with me to go get some liquor. And we talked on the phone. We said that we were going to meet up, but he didn't show up. So I know that he's dead now. Obviously, his funeral has happened, but that's all I can tell you. I didn't see him at all that night. And they were like, okay, that's fine. So they let him go. While they're walking him out, they hold the door open for him. Jean-Pierre hops in his car and he drives away, and the police are watching him drive away. And they said, look at this man driving a maroon color Chevy Caprice. Ain't that the car we looking for? Now, this, of course, was really great for the police, but here's the thing. The eyewitness said that they saw the car. They did not see a license plate. They didn't see a person driving. They can't tell you if it was black, white, woman, man. They don't know who was driving the car. They just saw, like, the end of the car leaving. And you can't just arrest a man because he owns a maroon color Chevy Caprice that you can't connect any other way to a crime. So they had to let him go. And the police were like, we know that he's involved somehow, just can't figure it out. And you have to arrest people with real cause, not just because you want to. After the funeral was over, Eric's family was like, you know what? Constance had the little outburst. She showed her face at the funeral. She is not giving the energy that we feel like she should give. Let's call up the Atlanta police and just let them know what we're thinking. So they call up APB and they said, we think that Constance has something to do with his death. We don't know how. We don't know why. We feel like it's a setup somehow. This is just like our theory. Of course, you're going to have to prove it, but this is what we really need from you. And they're like, okay, thank you for bringing this to my concern. I will try to do what we can. Thank you so much, Eric's family. So police still at this time feel like it has something to do with Jean-Pierre. So they look up Jean-Pierre's phone records. It takes time, especially when it's not an emergency. You got a subpoena, you got to get a judge's order on it. You have to do a lot of things to get somebody's cell phone records. But when they get those cell phone records, they realize that his cell phone pinged on a cell phone tower 1.8 miles away from where Eric's body was found. And at one point, Eric's cell phone and Jean-Pierre's cell phone pinged off the same tower. So now you're going to tell me that y'all wasn't together? Just something to look into.
You know what the detectives always say? One time's a coincidence. Two times is a pattern.
One time is a coincidence. Two times is a murder.
So 2 weeks later, Eric's car is found 10 miles from where his body was found. And that car was wiped. Detailed. Not a lick of evidence, not a fingerprint, not a hair, not a drop of blood, not a goddamn thing that could answer any kind of question.
I know that's right. I
know that's right.
They was like, this shit ain't turn up nothing. And so this is where the case starts to go cold. They don't have any leads. Like, don't got no witnesses. Don't have nothing. Another week passes. It's now 3 weeks after the murder. And Constance calls APD. And if you're wondering, why would Constance call the Atlanta Police Department? Maybe to check up on how her husband's case is doing, see if they got any leads. No, Constance want to know why her insurance ain't paid out yet. Here's the thing. She had already had a funeral, so there's already a death certificate. I just don't know why you called the police to ask. Did they not issue something? They probably said still pending the police, and she's probably like, what are you pending? Because I should be able to get paid. But it was more so, I think their concern was
more so. A funeral is expensive.
So,
a casket is expensive. Flowers, expensive. I need your insurance. I mean, I am just saying.
This is all true.
It's 2 weeks, I get it.
We're at 3 weeks now, so I do get it. But also.
A funeral advance or something.
You didn't call to check on the case. You didn't call to see if there was any leads. You didn't call to seek justice for your recently passed husband. You called to see where that money at. And it's even if you called for both, you know what I mean? But to be like, why I'm not paid? All right, if you say so. Like, ma'am, do you have any other questions? No, I'm good. Like, she ain't concerned. It was like, she not concerned enough for me. What makes this crazier is that Constance is already dating, which isn't so far-fetched because you was already cheating with the nigga. You had already really moved on in your head, right? But she starts dating this man, Derrick Henry, and she starts talking to this man. I paid my cousin to kill Eric. Now, I don't know why she told this man that, but she did. Thought he could keep a secret, pillow talking. They're building a connection. She wants to lay it all out on the table. While this is weighing on her conscience and she felt the need to share, she's also dealing with some other stuff. Time has passed. It's 2 years after Eric's murder. Nobody's been arrested. The case is super duper cold. But in 2007, the bank calls Constance's cousin because we need them payments on this $10,000 loan.
And she said, excuse me, what?
What $10,000 loan? And it was like, ma'am, you came here back in 2005 and you got a loan for $10,000. And as of late, you have not been making your payments. You're about to default on this loan. Don't want to get into how that's going to affect your credit score and all of that. So you might want to start making these payments. Maybe we can work out a payment plan. She was like, I ain't take out no loan with y'all. So she running some numbers in her head. She thinking about, I took out a loan 2 years ago. And it all starts getting really clear to her. She said, this got Constance written all over it. She realized Constance stole her information, forged her signature, taken out a bank loan on her name, and is not paying back.
She didn't plan on it.
As a matter of fact, refused to pay it back. Constance like, girl, did this insurance money even hit yet? Did she ever get paid?
I don't know. But she took out the loan before he died.
I know, but she's like, I think she was expecting $500,000. If that shit ain't hit yet, she like, how the fuck you expect me to pay this $10,000 loan? I was supposed to get paid to pay that.
Why are you walking with the assumption that she planned on repaying that?
Because you will get caught. Ain't nobody letting you steal $10,000, fuck up their identity and credit, know who you are, and just gonna let that shit slide. If you have $500,000, pay that $10,000 and you could have been out of jail. That's why I feel like she should have paid it back.
I just don't.
Because if you wanted to be free, that's what you would have did.
I don't think she thought the consequences were gonna be as great as they were.
But as soon as you start saying you pressing charges, girl, you know you just did a murder for hire. You better figure it the fuck out.
Her cousin had probably had it with her at this point.
When you, right. Because the way she just knew it was Constance. But, like, she wasn't in her most sound mind. She wasn't making the best decisions. She was not great with her money. But yeah, when you do hot shit, you don't just keep doing hot shit. And if you got a chance to stay out of some extra hot shit and don't uncover your other hot shit, do that. You don't need to be drawing no attention to yourself. Lay low.
You gotta lay low.
There you go. The cousin pressed charges. She ain't got time for bullshit. She ain't playing with Constance no more.
And she told that judge, give her the max.
I ain't had, like, over it, okay? So, Constance gets indicted on identity theft, forgery, and theft of property. Y'all, they ended up giving her ass 40 years. I think she got, like, 20 for the identity theft, 10 for forgery, and 10 for theft of property. And they was not stacking it. They said, you're going to do one after the other after the other.
Which is, now, I feel like that's a lot. 40 years for $10,000? Hear me out. 40
years. Y'all say
years.
White collar crime is the way to go, but I ain't so sure now.
40 what? Years for $10,000? You know how, I know you've seen that video, because it's been in the discussion group, about Honey Boo Boo and her mama stealing all that money from her to fund her pill habit?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. Honey Boo Boo, you could put your mother in prison. She's not going to, but, like, 40 years for $10,000? You could give me 10 years for $10,000.
You know what I mean?
I don't think but she, like, thought she was going to get 40 years.
It just, it's crazy. You tried it. You super-duper tried it. Meanwhile, Eric's family is still looking for justice. They call in Fulton County. They going through the district attorney. Somebody, please, anybody, look into my brother's case, solve my brother's case, call my son's case. We need justice for Eric. Now, in November of 2008, we're now 2 years and 11 months after the murder, right? Fulton County Cold Case Unit takes a look at Eric's murder. And they're like, okay, some time has passed. We've got some new technology. What didn't we do the first time that we can try now? So, they start going through Jean-Pierre's phone records again, refreshing, trying to get a feel for the case, what could have been missed.
Right.
There are four calls that jumped out to them. There were two calls before Eric was murdered, and there was two calls right after Eric was murdered. Because, again, we've got too much coincidence around Jean-Pierre. We definitely want to look into him, right? So, mm-hmm. apparently, they see that Jean-Pierre called a man, Chris Tomlin, before Eric's murder. So, they said, wonder what he had to talk to Chris about. Let's go see. They look for Chris. Look him up. They see he's had a record. He's been in and out of jail. And Eric's car was found, like, 1 mile away from where Chris's address was at the time.
Mm-hmm. And what else?
And so they was like, that looks close enough for us to want to have a conversation with him. So they start looking, where does Chris live now? At the jailhouse. Easy peasy. Your boy Kristen got locked up over some other bullshit. Some old weed charges, you know, some niggas never learn. And the police was like, oh, let's go see what Christopher got to say. Let's see what Chris and Jean-Paul was talking about on the phone. So, on December 2nd of 2008, the police gonna question Christopher. They said, listen, buddy, we've got you. They ain't have him. We've got tons of evidence. They ain't had no evidence. This car was found a mile away from your house. We found Eric's car, and guess whose fingerprint we found inside of it? Not his, not nobody's. But Chris don't know that.
The police are allowed to lie to you, and they are lying to this man.
They said, I'm gonna lay it for you straight, buddy. You either testify in this case, or you go down for the whole thing. Yep, we've got enough to pin this all on you. And Chris was like, shit. I'll tell you what happened. Cut me, and he starts to lay it out. He says, before the murder, Corey calls him because Jean-Pierre called Corey, and they needed a gun. Corey ain't have one. He pulled up to Chris. He said, I sold him a gun for $125. They go to the gas station by the Six Flags. They wait for Eric. Christopher's hesitant. He to a gas station, they wait for Eric. They pull to some abandoned lot. Chris starts to get a weird feeling. Next thing he knows, Eric's dead. Chris is freaking out. He's got to flee the scene. Just like, listen, dead ass, I thought we was going to rob the nigga. I was here for a robbery. Then they killed the nigga. We still didn't even rob the nigga because he killed the nigga. And that's when I was out. That I did not sign up for. It was not a part of. I ain't plan it. I ain't really participate in it for real, for real. I sold them the gun for robbery purposes, not murder purposes. And I would just like that to be stated with y'all considering what y'all gonna work out for me. The police are like, got him. And they go to Jean-Pierre and they arrest him. He was charged with first-degree murder, felony murder, aggravated assault, conspiracy to commit murder, and possession of a firearm.
They just lied. Poe Christopher, you got lied to. The police are allowed to lie to you. I think I want a piece of merch that says that. Now, police are like, Christopher, you're going to have to tell us a little bit more, okay? Because I don't believe that you were just innocent in this whole thing. I don't believe that you just said, you just came up with a person that you did not know. All of a sudden there's a murder and you just put your hands in the air. I don't believe that. He was like, I promise. Like, there's somebody else that was there too. And you can ask him. They were like, there was somebody else there? And they're like, yes, this dude named Corey. They're like, okay, who is Corey? And he's like, I don't really know Corey. And they're like, what's Corey's last name? I don't know Corey's last name. His name is Corey. He was there. He's the reason why.
Damn, man, I told you this ain't Corey. I got to do everything for y'all. Investigate.
Right. He's like, Corey is the one that asked me for the gun because Jean-Pierre was his homeboy. I don't really know these people like that. And they were like, what else do you know?
I wasn't really part of this.
He was like, hey, what else do you know? He's like, I don't really know, man. Like, they said, I don't even know why this was happening. They just said that the dude that we was finna rob, his wife was mad at him about some money, and so they was finna rob him because the wife wanted him to be whatever. And they said, the wife? And he was like, yeah. You know how you say something, you realize you said something, you're like, yeah, right. The wife? And they're like, tell me more about the wife. And he's like, again, I don't know very much, but I do know that she orchestrated this whole thing, and I guess Jean-Pierre's the wife's cousin, I don't know. And they're like, oh my goodness, the red string connects again. APD is like, all right, let's go find Constance. We need to speak with her again. Let's look up where she lives right now. Oh, she lives in prison in Alabama. Everybody's so
love
easy to find.
She's so lucky these days.
Now, it says that they arrested her. I don't think this is actually how it happened. But imagine being in prison, serving out your 40-year sentence for $10,000. And the police come in that you've never seen before, not your regular COs. And they're like, ma'am, you're under arrest for murder.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I don't think that's how that happened. But she ends up getting charged with first degree murder, felony murder, aggravated assault, conspiracy to commit murder, and possession of a firearm. And the reason all of this was able to point back to her is because Christopher kept talking and they kept pushing. And they said, ma'am, we know that you were an integral part in planning your husband's murder back in 2005. Now, when Eric's family finds out that she has been charged with the murder of Eric, it's like a breath of fresh air, but also like, I already knew. Like, thank you so much. You guys finally have the evidence that you need to do what we already said.
Right.
And they said that they suspected it all along and people were not shocked. One of their friends was like, I just did not see this coming. Like, the two loved each other. But family, they get to see the dark, deep side.
Mm-hmm. They was there.
Right. And so this whole time, they have Christopher, who is going to take the stand and talk about everything that has happened. And they still are trying to find this Corey character. Because since they didn't have a last name, they really thought Corey didn't exist. They thought that Christopher made Corey up at the very last minute to try and say that he had a witness and maybe plead his case. But really, they thought that Corey was a made-up figure. Christopher is a star witness. And then, lo and behold, like, literally the weekend before trial is about to start for Jean-Pierre, they find Corey. Corey said, absolutely, I know everything that happened that night. I know that it was the wife. I know that he was the person that pulled the trigger. And Corey testifies in trial that coming, like, Monday. And here's the thing, like, the defense really didn't have a chance to really talk to Corey. Because witnesses, everybody gets a chance to have a moment with. And they didn't really get that with Corey. But then Corey testifies against Jean-Pierre. Of course, Christopher testifies against Jean-Pierre. And Jean-Pierre went to trial, and baby, they found him guilty. They put him in the prison, life
plus an additional 25 years. That's where Jean-Pierre is already. Now, Constance's trial begins in August of 2011.
Take that shit to trial, bitch. Take that shit to trial, bitch. Take that shit to trial, bitch. Take that shit to trial.
And there was a bit of strategy going into her trial. So the jury was not made aware of Jean-Pierre, who was already serving time for his role in the murder. And they also were not aware that she was currently in prison on some fraud charges, because that would affect the jury and how they look at her. Obviously, she is wearing everyday clothes while she is standing in front of the jury pleading her case. The prosecution, they were very full of themselves going into this. They felt like they had everything they needed because they had those testimonies. Corey was willing to testify against Constance and Christopher again. So they were ready to go ahead and tell the side of the story that needed to be told. They said that it was going to be a slam dunk. And the judge said, before any of y'all get started, there is no such thing as a slam dunk in justice. So pipe down.
He said, not here, not today.
Not in this court. The DA was Paul Howard Jr. and the ADA was Pat Dutcher. And in their opening arguments, they talked about how she was a scammer and money is what motivated Constance to kill her husband. And what the jury was going to find out today, that the day that this man was found hours away from home is 6 months after she puts out a very pricey life insurance policy on him. Coincidence? I think not. They bring up Antoine. And Antoine talked about how when he saw Constance at the barbershop 3 months before this man winds up dead, she jokes around and says, fuck Eric. I need to collect life insurance on his ass. I know this is the second time of us telling that part, but that still gets me. Because, wow, the district attorney has everything it needs. Cell phone records between Jean-Pierre and Constance weeks before the murder, days leading up to the murder, a couple days after the murder. Then, of course, Christopher goes up and tells his side of the story and how he heard from Jean-Pierre and from Corey that she was the mastermind behind this entire night going down, a night that he did not expect to be a part of. What I found interesting is that Eric's body, of course, was taken in. It was autopsied, but the medical examiner that did the autopsy didn't testify at either trial, not at Constance's trial and not at Jean-Pierre's. It could be because maybe his time was up and he was on vacation, retired somewhere, but there was another that basically broke down to the jury what the medical examiner at that time had discovered, including those gunshot wounds to his head and his torso, being shot a total of 5 times, and 2 of those shots were fatal, the shot to the head and the shot to the torso.
Jean-Pierre was cold-blooded, dog. Corey Branch was also called as a witness, and he confirmed everything that Christopher was saying this entire time, including the fact that it was Constance's idea. He also speaks to Jean-Pierre telling both of them that Constance agreed to give him $5,000 to kill Eric. Now, Constance's defense gets up there, and they're like, there were no ill intentions behind her taking that money and getting a life insurance policy on her husband. And this so-called star witness hasn't even met Constance before. They don't even know each other. This is all hearsay, basically, through Jean-Pierre. Like,
and Jean-Pierre, they don't even have a fingerprint. They have no DNA evidence. They have another right. man's story.
Right, but they're like, if it was so ill-intentioned for her to get a life insurance policy, why would she also take one out on herself? Yeah, there were 2 policies. They both got insured. That's just what you do to protect your family, okay? They even start poking holes in the phone records. Of course she was calling Jean-Pierre. Her husband, Eric, was meeting up with him that night to get the liquor. Of course she was helping coordinate it. These are not suspicious phone calls with him being in town. It makes perfectly good sense. She was just checking on her husband and checking on her cousin. Basically, Constance's defense was like, at the end of the day, Constance is not the problem, Jean-Pierre is. Jean-Pierre has evil ways about him, and when he found out that Eric was coming to Atlanta without her, Jean-Pierre gathered around his friends, and they decided to rob and kill Eric themselves. They really laid it on thick. Constance is a doting wife. She's just caught up in the middle. Let her grieve in peace. And it was up to the jury to decide who they believed. Was Jean-Pierre this evil criminal mastermind who just killed Eric for no reason and left $500 in his wallet? Or did Constance hire him to do it? The jury deliberated for 8 hours and at a point got deadlocked. Because, I mean, I think it's got to be reasonable doubt. Like, is this a believable story? Do we truly believe, like, he acted on his own? Was she the loving wife? Was she sinister? Like, we don't know. They legit haven't met. Two of the people involved never even met. Live in different states. It's no DNA evidence. It was hard, right? They had a lot to think about. But at the end, they came back and found Constance guilty on all charges. Constance was sentenced to life in prison plus 5 years. The judge asked if there was anything that she wanted to say to the family, and she said, no. Not an apology. Not, I wish it didn't go down like this. Not even a half-assed apology. Just no. Not even a plea, I ain't do it. I'm going to be fighting, you know what I'm saying? I'm love my, no, nothing. Eric's dad was like, life in prison was not enough for her. He said that he hates her, but he feels sorry for her because he knows that evil's not all she is. Like, I've seen the good side of Constance, but at the end of the day, you took my son away from me. And for that,
they said, flip the switch.
You think you want that to happen, and then she's gone, you still got that hole in your heart. But he's like, his whole thing is her family gets to visit her, but will they? It's a hassle. It costs money. She done screwed over her cousin real bad. Two cousins. She done got two cousins fucked up at this point. Who is she really leaning on at this point? Eric's sister April said now she has to sit in jail and she has to think about the person that she killed. For the rest of her life, you're going to sit in that jail and you're going to think about my brother. Janice, Eric's mom, said that, quote, she wanted more than Eric's love. She wanted to satisfy a habit, and he couldn't do that for her. And that cost him his life, which is sad. That's so tragic, man.
Mm-hmm.
To lose somebody over some bullshit, it, like, you can never regulate that in your mind. Like, it truly feels like it's an act that wasn't supposed to happen. Hit the undo button. Like, there was better decisions to be made.
Right. And then by that time, he gonna be old by the time you move out. She gonna die in Alabama. I mean, it's just Georgia, but you're gonna transfer to the Georgia prison in your 60s. All the old bitches in there are gonna already know each other. You gonna be the new old bitch. Ugh.
Constance was set to serve 40 years in an Alabama prison, and then she'll be transferred to a Georgia prison to spend the rest of her life. So basically, she gonna do her fraud charges in Alabama for fucking over her cousin, and then she gonna pay for Eric in Georgia. Christopher Tumlin pleaded guilty to voluntary manslaughter. He got 10 years and was eligible for release in 2021. And Corey was not charged with any crime. I think he traded his testimony and got a sweet deal in the end. In 2015, Jean-Pierre appeals his conviction. He says that the court erred by, one, they took two black jurors off of his jury pool or whatever. He wants a member of his peers, of course. The reason that they took them, though, was that one said she had a bad experience with police and prosecutors, and it was like, she's a little biased. And another one said that he had a brother that had died in prison, and he held a grudge against the lawyers because they were incompetent. And so they was like, y'all don't feel like y'all gonna be impartial. We're gonna have to get y'all out of here. He said that they should not have allowed Corey to testify because they threw him in there last minute. But they was like, we just found out. We didn't know this nigga was a real person.
Right.
They found him the Friday before trial began. And they was like, and if you thought we was going to let that slide, no. We told y'all as soon as we found out this is special circumstances. You didn't even know his full name. I mean, Christopher didn't even know his full name. Like, we did what we could do. We did our best. And then lastly, he appealed saying that the evidence obtained was in violation of his Miranda rights. He was like, yo, when they asked me for my phone number, I didn't know that they was going to be looking into my phone records. I wasn't Mirandized at that point. I didn't know anything I said could and would be used against me.
Right.
He was like, I don't give a fuck about none of that. Court seems to be in good standing. We're going to uphold your conviction. Your appeal's not granted. This same year, 2015, Constance also appealed her conviction. She says that the evidence presented at the trial was insufficient to support her convictions. And they were kind of like, we had a pretty good trail. Y'all were a tough spot financially. Your marriage was on the rocks. Your cousin is involved. Life insurance policies. I think we had enough evidence. So the court upheld that. And then she also tried to say that the prosecutor was offering unsworn testimony in the opening argument. He did a lot of references to Christopher's statements that he made. And, like, that was like, how you gonna start off with somebody else's testimony and it's not somebody else giving that testimony? She ain't like that. The court was like, we don't find nothing wrong with that either. And her appeal was also denied.
So, nowadays, everybody is still alive. In 2017, Eric's mom made a post on his obituary wall, like the online wall, and it says, Eric Clark, my loving son, my heart still carries you and my love will never end. You were a blessing for me from birth and gave me so much love and wisdom to get through the most hurting thing in my life, parentheses, losing you. Let go and let God. God was there and he provided what he needed to get justice for your life here on earth and rewarded you for the lives you touched in the short time that you were here. I miss you just like it was yesterday, but every day I am trying to prepare to be with you again, Mom. Very sweet. Constance is currently at the Tutwiler Annex in Alabama. She will be there until 2033. From there, she will be transferred to the Georgia State Prison System. Jean-Pierre is at Macon State Prison, and his younger sister, her name is Ashley. She has made a Facebook page, multiple posts, multiple outcries to the public stating her brother's innocence. She says she really has no idea why all of a sudden this drug deal between Corey and Eric went awry, but she believes that her brother, Jean-Pierre, is being used as a scapegoat because really the person that they're scared of is Corey. Actually, everybody calls him Big Corey. And Big Corey was the person that really pulled the trigger. And Big Corey is the one that started calling and threatening everybody, including Jean-Pierre. So if Big Corey is the one that's threatening everybody, of course, that's why Christopher pointed at Jean-Pierre. And of course, that's why he stayed low. And when he was ready, pointed the finger at Jean-Pierre. And one of the big things is, you know, there's no physical evidence. Really, there isn't. There's really just one person's story versus the others.
Who are you going to believe?
She said that Constance and Jean-Pierre weren't even that close. So for her to even ask him to do something as crazy as murder, like, that doesn't make sense. So this Facebook page is very active proclaiming Jean-Pierre's innocence.
I do think he probably said, out of reasonable doubt, get off. Like,
you know what I'm saying? I don't know if he did it or not, but I do think there is enough reasonable doubt. And that's what a lot of people do not understand. And you have to hope that you have a jury that does understand. And I think that's why he was upset about those witnesses being struck. Christopher was released on September 14th, 2021. And like we said, Corey got immunity. And this is the story of Constance Clark. All right, y'all, it's time for...
Well, I'm not black. I'm OJ.
I didn't do it, but if I did, this is how I would have got away with it. I didn't do it, but if I did, I would have stayed in rehab.
I didn't do it, but if I did,
ooh, lordy.
Don't blow up your spot when it's hot. Pay your debts. Don't be stealing from your family. She fucked up a lot of ways.
That's really like...
I was gonna pay.
Don't be killing
you
the
back,
man that's providing.
But then I got high. I was gonna get up and even pay tax. Well, then I got high. Now I'm locked up in prison, and I know why. Why, man?
Hey, why, man? Hey,
because I got high. Because I got high. Because I got high.
I didn't do it, but if I did, whew. Girl, I would not call the police department asking about my life insurance money. You call the insurance company and you make the insurance company be on the police's ass. Because I get it. You owed your money. You're really not because you orchestrated the whole thing. If you were an innocent woman, you would still be owed your money.
Right. But, like, follow through. Be concerned. Also, y'all always fuck up killing niggas and not robbing them.
Yes.
$500 in his pocket, and y'all knew he had money because he came to buy a shit ton of liquor.
And his ID? Why are you leaving it there?
I tell you what, though. That nigga did a hell of a job cleaning that car out, though.
They didn't find anything. The police are allowed to lie to you. They didn't find anything in that car, and they told him they found his fingerprint, and that nigga folded. You should have called a lawyer. I just feel like if I'm going to be the mastermind behind anything, I need everybody to know what to do and what to do in the worst case scenario. I need everybody to be on one accord. I don't need no slip-ups.
One band, one sound.
And... ugh. Call a lawyer. They say they got a fingerprint. I would like to speak to a lawyer, please. You already in jail. Mm-hmm. You got one you can call. In jail.
What are they going to do? Send you back? Like, your conditions have not changed.
Hell no.
Like, shit, I'm on a weed chart. I'm going to be out soon enough. Y'all niggas talking murder.
Now look at you. I ain't do it, but if I did... This has also got the ones that we always say, don't kill men that were formerly in the military, even though he wasn't in the military for long. Don't kill men that have strong black women in their lives. Do not kill men that have sisters. Like, stop doing that.
Learn your lesson already.
Okay, yeah, that's it. I'm sure people will have some. Put them in the discussion group.
Yeah.
Let's read some reviews. Let's go. If you want to leave us a review, if you made it to this point of the show, the story is over and I'm glad that you're here. You might as well be following the podcast so that you can automatically get downloads when new episodes drop. Leave us a review. You may hear your review on the show because we like to do them, pick them at random, and it really helps us feel good. I hope it makes you feel good. Okay. This one says, this is from Megan A. This one is 5 stars, says, excellently delivered. I finally listened to all of your shows, and now I have to wait till Friday like everybody else. Y'all are my new besties. I'm a May Taurus as well, and my bestie, also known as my baby sister, is a Scorpio, and we act just like y'all. Mm-hmm. I really love the show, and I also love when Marah busts out in song because I do the same thing. Keep up the great work and dropping hits. Love y'all. She spelled it Murrah, M-U-R-R-A-H. That's mm-hmm. a new one. I kind of like, that one gives you the pronunciation.
Thank you so much. This one says, badass sisters. Murrah and Taz are the absolute best. I love listening to these two. They're real and raw, and they don't censor who they are. They do their research for every episode, and it shows. I love how they end each episode with, I ain't do it, but if I did, and parole or no parole, and they give their own thoughts, and it's great. You girls keep doing you, and don't stop being amazing. Much love from Vermont.
Thanks. We didn't do parole and parole this episode. We didn't do that. We didn't do that part of this episode. We just forgot. Don't worry. I would parole her for those forgery charges. 40 years for $10,000?
You sick about that, ain't you?
I'm sick
and
about it.
And it's crazy because you're really going to parole her for it just so she can hurry up and start her life sentence.
That's fine. Go do your thing in Georgia.
I think Jean-Pierre should get a retrial. I think Constance can stay her ass wherever the fuck. In one of these prisons, she ain't going nowhere.
She ain't going nowhere.
Chris free. And Corey never got locked up. So, yeah, I think right. at least do another retrial for Jean-Pierre. Lay it out clean. Build a better case.
Amazing. Great. I totally agree. Let's wrap this show up. Let's tell the people fun things. You want to tell them, Taz?
We... will be at CrimeCon this May 31st through June 2nd. It's in Nashville. We started off on Creators Row, but we just got offered an opportunity to be speakers. We're so excited. Come see us at CrimeCon.
That's right. We are speaking to the girls. We are telling them the things. Do you want to tell them our subject? I think that might make people excited.
Maybe let's get it approved first.
Okay. We are speaking at the things. We are very excited to have upgraded from Creators Row to actually being on the program. So if you want to come see us, there's a coupon code. What is it, Tazzy? It's sisters.
S-I-S-T-A-S. Not sisters with an E-R. You got to treat it like niggas. Don't use the E-R. It's the A-S.
Not with an H.
Mm-mm. Not that either. Y'all trying to do too much.
SIS
TAS so that you can come. There are so many fun people on the lineup, including your girls. So make sure that you check us out at Crime Con. I think that's everything. Do you have anything else, friend?
Talk to us. We talk back.
Bye.
Bye.